Blog Talk Radio.
Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you. Full Power Living with host Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, will begin at the top of the hour, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. In the meantime, please enjoy the music. Thank you.
More than 15 million people in the United States have been diagnosed with cancer today. That makes the chances that you know or care for someone with cancer very great. Considering we Americans don't like to talk about death and other messy issues, many of us feel unprepared to love and support and care for someone with cancer. So today, I've invited an eminently qualified person to talk with us about how best to talk with and relate to people and care for them that we know and love who have cancer, Stan Goldberg. So welcome to Full Power Living, where we're helping the world to realize and work with the importance, power, and mastery of human emotions. We welcome your questions and comments. We have chats on blogtalkradio.com/FPL and on the radio show page of emotionalpro.com. So Stan Goldberg, PhD, is Professor Emeritus of Communicative Disorders at San Francisco State University. He's also the author of the new book, Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. Stan is a prolific award-winning writer. He's an editorial consultant, a recognized expert in the area of cancer support. And he also works with end-of-life issues, caregiving, chronic illnesses, aging, and change. He has received 22 national and international awards for his workshops and interviews, and he was a bedside volunteer at the internationally renowned Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. He's also worked at Hospice by the Bay, George Mark Children's House, and Pathways Home Health and Hospice. You can find out more about him by going to Stan Goldberg, B-E-R-G, StanGoldbergWriter.com. So, Stan Goldberg, welcome to Full Power Living.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the offer.
It's my pleasure. I actually was very touched by reading your book. My husband, Bob, as many of our listeners know, died of complications from prostate cancer at the beginning of this year. And as I read your book, I so wished I'd had it available during the 5 years that I was dealing with his illness, because I actually felt that I would be more compassionate than I was able to be. I struggled. I worked to be as loving as possible. But you've really explained a lot of things that were puzzling and with which I struggled. And so I want to start by asking you, what motivated you to write the book?
Well, about 20 years ago, I received a phone call from a good friend of mine. And some of the first words out of her mouth after saying hello were, I have stage 4 breast cancer. And I did not know how to respond. So I said what most people do, which is, I'm so sorry to hear about that. And if there's anything I can do, please let me know. And I thought about that afterwards. And I thought, you know, even though I was expressing my compassion towards her, there was nothing really there that was helpful. And I thought, wouldn't it have been nice if I knew what else to say? Well, about 7 years after that, it was my turn to say the same thing to people that I knew and loved when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And when I said to people, you know, I've got prostate cancer, their response was identical to mine. And that was, I'm so sorry to hear that. Let me know if there's anything I can do. And I realized that in those, and that response kept getting repeated, and I realized that in those intervening years, nothing really had changed. And I knew that there was a better way of interacting with people who had cancer. At about that same time, I became a bedside hospice volunteer. And from the patients that I served, I started learning what it was that was helpful to them and what wasn't. And I carried that into my counseling of caregivers. So it was a long process of learning, you know, what the needs were, and then having people provide me with the answers for making the situation better.
Yes. Well, your chapter on communication comes late in your book, but as you're saying that, I think your idea of what to say to someone with cancer is the first hurdle we do encounter. At Thanksgiving this year, in fact, a woman I know told me that she was diagnosed with breast cancer just a month previously. And I may have said all the wrong things, but she was very charitable and kept talking to me, because what I went through was I was at first shocked, and then I felt compassion toward her. But I still wasn't, you know, I just went, oh, that's really terrible. And I, you know, she started telling me what she'd done so far and what was lying ahead. And, we got into a conversation. But what's the best thing to say in a situation like that when somebody says that?
Yeah, well, there's two sides of it. The first one is, I wouldn't be as concerned about selecting the right words as some people are. You know, the fact that someone is sharing with you their diagnosis, you know, I view that as an invitation. I mean, I don't tell people I have cancer if I don't have a connection with them in some way. So, you know, don't be that concerned about the exact choice of words. It's not going to make as much difference as knowing how to take that compassion that you have and transforming that into helpful behaviors. I'll give you a very good example. I had a friend of mine who was beginning to undergo chemotherapy. And so she called me and we were talking, and in the process of the conversation, she said that the following week, I think it was like on a Wednesday, she was going to have chemotherapy. And I knew that, you know, following the infusion of those chemicals, she was going to be pretty exhausted.
Right.
So what I said, instead of saying to her, I'm so sorry, I my heart is with you, or any of those other phrases that are heartfelt, what I said to her was, okay, you know, if I remember correctly, you do your grocery shopping on Thursdays. I will be over at 9 o'clock in the morning. We will shop together. I'll bring you back. I'll put all the groceries away, and we'll look to see if anything else needs to be done, because you might be too tired to do that. Well, that was more beneficial to her than any other words I could have possibly chosen. So that's the two-part suggestion I would have is, one, don't be that concerned about the specific words, and two, whatever it is you're going to say, be sure that can be translated into practical and useful behaviors.
Yes. You know, during the time my husband was ill, we were living in our home, and our next-door neighbors were a doctor and an emergency room doctor and his wife, who also worked in another emergency room. And they, especially the wife, did exactly what you're talking about. The day my husband died, she showed up with a pot of soup for the whole family who was there. They would come over and visit my husband and put their hand on my shoulder. And they took action, and especially the wife was especially great at knowing exactly what to do that I needed help with. It was kind of amazing. And I did feel so supported, and so did my husband. And that's part of what you're talking about when you're talking about turning compassion into action. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, and there's some people that can do that fairly easily because they've had lots of experiences doing that. For example, you know, the nurse that you just mentioned, you know, mm-hmm. she's had to do that probably 5, 6, 7 times a day. So she understands what the needs were. But most of us really don't know, you know, how to change our compassion mm-hmm. into actions. And that's why I wrote the book. And in the book, there's over, I believe, something like 260 very specific things that can be done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some are very simple, such as listen more and talk less. You know, something my mother, you know, advised me to do when I was 10. So it's you know, a whole bunch of those very simple things that can make a significant difference.
Right. That's really true. So one of the things that I wish I had understood better is what goes on when a person dealing with cancer gets very stubborn, or they withdraw, or they react in ways that are uncharacteristic for them. If you want to be loving and care for a cancer patient, what do we need to know to better help them at times such as those?
I think the baseline is an understanding that the person living with cancer is functioning in a world very different than someone who is healthy. And I know that when I was diagnosed, I started seeing everything through my diagnosis. Will I be around, you know, to see my children have children? Will I be around to finish a book I'm working on? Should I accept this invitation to go to a party knowing that I may not be feeling that great? And these are the types of everyday decisions the person living with cancer faces. And it really changes significantly sometimes how they interact with other people. And what may appear to be bizarre or strange behaviors really aren't, if you think about them in terms of the person who is unsure how long they're going to live, and if they do have a longer life, what that life will consist of.
You know, you remind me, I had a rather unusual, what I thought was an unusual situation. A woman that I had known for many years was a medium, a psychic, and she had helped me as a single parent with many issues. And when I followed her advice, it was very good. About a month before my husband got ill, she said to me, we don't see him living very much longer. But she didn't ever tell me what very much longer meant. I didn't know how long that was. But the strange thing was that two or three other people with psychic abilities over the next two or three years also told me he wasn't going to live much longer. And that put me in a very strange position, which I think speaks to what you're talking about there, which is, I didn't talk to him about it. I didn't want to influence his progress. But the deal was that I had an awareness of where this was all going, and yet my job was still to live in the present moment in the everyday world. And that was quite a challenge.
It's a challenge that most caregivers face. And that is, you know, they usually have to walk this very fine line between being realistic and being hopeful. And sometimes we jump over one side farther than we should. And it's usually on the side of hope. You know, I mean, we all want to hope that there will be some miracle that will cure the person that we love, something that will prolong their life for many years. I know that when I was originally diagnosed and with a very uncertain prognosis, you know, I sat down with my wife and my two adult children and explained to them what was going on, that essentially I would never be rid of the prostate cancer because it had gone beyond the gland and it had been carried through my body and there were these microscopic cells that were living.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how much they hoped that it would be a gone, we needed to talk about what would happen if it didn't. What would happen if the drugs that I was taking would no longer be effective? So what I did was I initiated that conversation. So you know, everybody in the family was on the same page. You know, we were all looking that I would have as good a life as I possibly can have, but weren't, believing that there would be a magical cure. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it was easy for my family to deal with it because I initiated that.
Right.
But quite often, there's nobody to initiate that. You know, people are afraid of talking about a person's cancer because they know the possibilities that lay there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very difficult issue, but it's one that I think people need to be constantly aware of, and that is those of us who are living with cancer don't want cheerleaders. You know, we have a pretty good idea of what's going on. We want people who are supportive of how we are adapting to living with our cancer.
That's interesting to me. I've had experience with at least three people dying of cancer that were close to me. And one of the things that was challenging for me to understand is something you're skirting on there is how people view the possible outcome of their illness. My husband's previous wife, for example, I ended up doing a step-parent adoption of their child. So we had some connection and she refused to accept that she was dying until maybe 3 days before she died when her brother, who is a psychiatrist, sat her down and said, you've got to make some decisions. On the other hand, my sister, who was 22 months older than me, she faced her cancer more like you were talking about, absolutely directly. She had been a dancer and a performance teacher, and she orchestrated, she went to support groups, she contacted all of her friends and said goodbye to them. And the amazing thing is that she gave two nights in a row, she gave a 1 hour dance theater performance 7 weeks before she died. And that was a profound experience. I'll tell you about it more if you're interested.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I think that what many people don't realize is there are certain things that happen with someone who is living and also dying with cancer that are very profound. I was a bedside hospice volunteer for 8 years, and what I kept seeing is as people got closer to dying, there was a rearranging of priorities. You know, what had been important in someone's life in the past may no longer have been. And through this rearranging of priorities and understanding really what was important in life, what happened was, you know, I was invited into people's lives where they were being unbelievably honest about things. And I think the same thing applied to, you know, to your friend who was the dancer. You know, knowing that you only have a limited amount of time to live has a tremendous effect not only on what you say, but also on what you do. And, I mean, I would have loved to have seen that performance. I've been at certain musical performances of people who knew they were, you know, getting closer to dying, and they were unbelievable. So, yes, yeah, something happens as people get closer to death. And you're right, it's not the same for everybody. It was interesting. Before we started the interview, I was looking at some comments on an interview that I gave to the New York Times, and where someone thought I was maintaining that everybody views their cancer identically. And clearly that's not what I think. And I think what happens is we bring into the present our past history. You know, someone who was evasive before their diagnosis might have some difficulty dealing with the actual diagnosis or talking to friends about it. Other people who were open about their emotions will tell a lot of different people. So, yes, we are all unique. We all react differently to our cancer. And regardless of how we do that, the person who is healthy and, you know, our partner or our family or our friends need to understand that that's how we're viewing the possibility of dying. We're viewing it through our history and our values and our needs.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, I do want to tell you a little bit more about my sister's performance, because she did something that you address in your book that I think is important. She, my sister, characteristically, she'd been dancing for a number of years, and I knew that occasionally she completely disrobed in her dances, but I discovered that actually in almost every dance that was part of what she did. And this time she took her clothes off, she removed them, and started talking with the audience about what cancer had done to her dancer's body. And, you know, she was flapping the skin on her arms, for example. And then she walked directly up to her audience and looked people in the eye, again, totally naked, and then said to people, "Don't make me into an object. I'm still in here." And that was powerful.
That is the best. Yeah, that's the best story I've ever heard about about someone revealing what cancer has done to them. And, you know, that's the kind of honesty that I wish more people would emulate, is to just to share with folks what they're feeling about their cancer and how it has affected their lives.
It was very powerful, and she was so conscious that she called her friend Charles and me into the room about 24 hours before she died, told us how she was working to turn loose, and invited us to, she said, "I'm turning my body." My sister actually was a fairly controlling person, but she said, "I'm turning my body over to you. Don't ask me if I'm cold. Don't ask me if I need liquids. And you can start giving me the morphine cocktail now." And she died 24 hours later. She was so deliberate.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that with a lot of people, don't realize is those of us who are living with cancer are very well aware of what's happening to ourselves. And those folks who are farther on that journey than I am, who are getting closer to dying, know their bodies are giving up. So, you know, it doesn't make sense to be afraid to talk about death with someone who is close to it. The only thing that I would suggest is not to necessarily initiate those conversations.
Right.
Allow the person with the cancer to start them. Because what I found in my counseling is if you try to bring along a person into discussing a topic they're not ready for, the only result is more defenses are created. So, you know, allow your loved one to initiate that conversation. And when they do, don't run away.
Yes, I think that's really powerful. You remind me that one final thing I'll say about my sister is when she called Charles and me in, she told us that she was working to push the world away. And she didn't like I was her younger sister. She didn't like taking advice from me, but I did ask her if I could give her a suggestion about that, and she accepted it. And I said that I think that trying to push the world away, you're placing your attention on the world, and that will make it harder. So I suggested that she use her imagination to see herself stepping off of the world. And she said, I can do that, and proceeded forward with that, which to me was very beautiful that we could share that.
Yeah, it was, and that's such a wonderful thing to do. When I was in hospice, one of the things that I tried to do with the people I served was to help them get to that place. And one of the things that I would often do is I would bring in some of my flutes, and I play the Native American flute and some other, you know, the shakuhachi, which is a Japanese bamboo flute, and some others. And you know, what I tried to do was to help them to someplace else. And there was one very quick story. I was there was a new flute that I had recently purchased, and I was really concerned about the ability to play it, because I didn't want to screw up, because this individual only had, you know, probably a couple of weeks left to live. So I was very concerned about it. And the minute I started playing, the situation itself seemed to be controlling my fingers and playing something I had never played before at a level that I had never experienced. And when I was done, there was a nurse, a hospice nurse there, and she went to the person and said, did you like that? And he nodded his head, which made me feel better. And then she said, where did it take you? And his response was, to a place you can't come yet. And which you know, it sort of floored me, but made me realize that, yeah, there are a lot of different ways you can help someone as you're getting closer to dying. And a lot of ways are very deliberate. Others are ephemeral, just like providing music. So, I mean, what the advice you gave was perfect.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I laugh only because I just have to tell you this story. My sister, one day I asked her if she'd been having dreams of people in our family who had died before her. And she looked down her nose at me and said, I'm going to tell you the same thing that other people have, that I've told other people that want me to validate their beliefs. No. And about 3 years after she died, I had someone on this radio program who's told me that she communicated with the dead. And so I asked her if she could contact my sister to find out if there was anything that my sister had encountered, because my sister did not believe, you know, you die, you're dead, that's it. There's nothing else. And the woman claimed that she did contact my sister, and it sounded enough like my sister to both make me laugh and make me believe, because my sister's response was, as usual, Eileen, you were right.
Well, you know, I often, you know, when I do presentations, I get questions that, you know, when people know that I've been a hospice, you know, volunteer, whether I believe in the afterlife.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my response to everybody is pretty much the same, which is, you know, I can only tell you what I've experienced. And,
uh-huh.
you know, there have been some people that have talked about things that they saw that I don't think can be explained away by, you know, dying brain cells like many neurologists would think. But I don't know what they are. But to me, there's something going on. You know, I clearly am not wise enough to understand what it is, but it seems to offer me some hope for, you know, when it's my turn to die.
Yes, yes, that's really wonderful. So we're up to a break here, Stan. And when we come back, one of the things we'll be talking about is expressing our own feelings when we are caring for someone who has cancer. This is Soul Power Living, and we'll be right back.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com.
So welcome back. I'm talking today with Stan Goldberg, who's an award-winning writer, editorial consultant, and recognized expert in the area of cancer support, end-of-life issues, caregiving, chronic illnesses, aging, and change, a lot of the things we don't usually like to talk about. Before we get back into talking with Stan, I want to make a couple of announcements. Next week, we're adventuring into the world of the Hollywood stunt woman. When I talk with Lisa Loving Dalton, she's the author of Falling for the Stars, A Stunt Gal's Tattletales. And not only has Lisa doubled for stunts for many famous stars, males and females, but she has learned many secrets about healing her body that she will be sharing with us. So join us next Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time for my talk with Lisa Dalton. We also have many wonderful shows scheduled for you, so go to our homepage, it's emotionalpro.com, click subscribe. We'll put you on the list so you get notification of our upcoming shows. And if you wish to subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes, there's an iTunes button in the middle also. And when you do listen via iTunes, will you please submit your comments and ratings? Well, today I'm talking with the author of Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient, Stan Goldberg. And Stan, you've mentioned here that you were diagnosed with prostate cancer many years ago, and you've been able to manage it successfully for more than a decade. And you still get the hormone injections as you need them. And so I wanted to ask you, what are some of the hardest challenges of knowing that you have cells in your body that can go berserk and start choking off your life, while at the same time having them somewhat under control so you can keep living your life? We've skirted on this, but what's it been like for you?
Well, I think that the biggest problem for me and for the other people that I've spoken to who've lived with cancer is uncertainty. And, you know, I feel it in two different ways. One is I really don't know how much longer I have to live. I do know that with most prostate cancer, there is a limited amount of time that whatever intervention protocol is being used works. You know, somehow these little microscopic cancer cells are very bright, and they can figure out eventually how to negate the effects of treatments that are being given. And that's why there's a whole series of steps that are involved. So, you know, that's one of the issues. That I am less concerned about the length of time I have left than I am about the losses that I've been incurring because of the cancer. So, for example, before I was diagnosed, I was an avid fly fisherman, and I would go out into the wilderness areas and I would by myself, and I would go out 5-6 days and backpack and fish. And that became a part of my identity. That was very important to me. Mm-hmm. That was one of the first things that I lost. Because, you know, with the cancer treatments, I really became too weak to do that activity by myself without, you know, raising huge concerns with my family. So, mm-hmm. you know, that was the first one. People who have any form of cancer that's progressive or one that is, even chronic, will suffer different kinds of losses. And every time you have one of these losses, the result is, at least for me and for many people I've counseled, there's a change in your identity. You become somewhat different. So it's the uncertainty that I think is the greatest problem, and knowing that there's a potential loss of abilities that affect most people who are living with cancer.
Excuse me. I think one thing you talk very sensitively about in your book, too, is that once you've been invaded, or once you know that you're invaded by these proliferating cells, the uncertainty spreads to, oh, my left arm is hurting. What does that mean? Is there cancer in my left arm? When it might not even be relevant, but it leaves you vigilant, I suppose, would be the word.
And not only vigilant, it leaves you sometimes scared. You know, like I know with prostate cancer that once it starts proliferating, it'll start developing tumors, usually in the bones.
Yes.
So the minute that I have any kind of even minor discomfort in any skeletal part of my body, I start having concerns. And, you know, I sort of developed my own protocol for saying, okay, should I get really concerned about this, or should I just chalk this up to fear? And, you know, sometimes I can't tell the difference between the two. And the first thing I do is I call my oncologist, who was a very sensitive guy. And I say, hey, this is what's going on. And his comments are, forget about it, has nothing to do with cancer, or let's watch it, or the third is, let's do some testing. So that's there for most people with cancer. They just don't know whether something, you know, some part of their body is just normally having some difficulties or it's related to cancer. And I'm 71, so, you know, I know the ravages of aging. So you factor in both aging and cancer, and you come out with a volatile mix.
Yes, I say. I just had my 74th birthday. So I'm with you here.
Okay.
In my own life and work, I have come to see our Earth as a giant school, Stan. It seems to me that we've all come here in order to learn and grow, and you who are listening, who are regular listeners, you know this. And so when I look at your suggestions for how to lovingly care for somebody with cancer, I am looking at the caretaker's growth. And I was looking for what are some of the things that you're actually offering in terms of growth lessons. it seems like you suggest that we develop deep empathy, that we learn to walk in the shoes of the other, that we love another person ahead of yourself, that we allow others to be different from us, and we operate as fully as possible in the present moment, all and at the same time being sure to love ourselves so that we can be there for the person who has cancer. So I was really impressed with how many lessons I found as I was reading through your book. Do you have comments on that?
Yeah, I think someone who has never been a caregiver doesn't understand that this is probably one of the most difficult human activities anybody could ever endeavor. And that's because, you know, when you think about what's involved in caregiving, well, it involves, you know, me caring for someone who can't do things by themselves, either limited things or many things. And it's an incredible responsibility that one is given. Sometimes, depending upon the condition of the person you're caring for, what you do may be the difference of their living or not. And on a less severe level, the quality of their life depends upon what you're doing. So that starts the equation. On one side, you have this tremendous responsibility, but you know you can't continually sacrificing your life for someone else's without there being dire consequences. And I encounter this often with caregivers that I counsel. And that is, you know, their understanding of caregiving is they need to continually sacrifice for the person they're caring for. What they don't realize is when they do that, two things happen to themselves. Physically, they get exhausted, and emotionally, they may start developing some animosity because they've given up everything.
Yes.
So for caregivers, what they need to do is, once again, is walk this balance between their needs and the needs of the person they're caring for. And it becomes a little bit easier when your frame of reference is one in which you understand that what the person is going through who has cancer is something that you can't figure out completely. So it involves acceptance, a lot of acceptance of what may be unacceptable behaviors if the person was healthy. And I think, you know, once you have that you start with that perspective of acceptance, then caregiving becomes a lot easier.
That's so profoundly true. Now, one of the ways, you know, I've been a psychotherapist for 44 years, and I specialize in emotions. So I know that emotions, or at least my understanding is that emotions are energy and that we need to keep that energy moving. And so I was delighted to see in your book that you suggest that as a caregiver, you go ahead and share your emotions with the cancer patient, but you also advise don't fall apart all over the cancer patient and make them take care of you. So talk about that fine line, will you please?
Yeah, I think that, and I guess I'm speaking to this as not only as a counselor, but someone who's a family caregiver. My brother-in-law died of brain cancer, and my family and I were providing him care for a year and a half during that time. My wife had a stroke a number of years ago. Fortunately, she's covered completely, but for 3 months, my daughter and I cared for her. Currently, my daughter has just undergone some ankle surgery, and now we're being caregivers for her. Mm. What I found is, in all three situations, that there were times when I was feeling less than compassionate, and most of that had to do with my own needs. Now, sometimes I just didn't say anything, and as a result of that, sort of harbored this animosity for a long time.
Yes.
And it neither did me good or did my family any good. But other times, when I shared what I was feeling, it not only brought us closer together, but it also resulted in some changes. So, for example, with my brother-in-law, since he was bedridden, you know, I would have to get everything for him and do everything for him. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't that he had a choice. But even though he didn't have a choice, it didn't mean that I wasn't affected by it. So, you know, I sat down and I explained to him that I was having some difficulty because of the different things that were involved, and I just didn't have time to do things. So together we worked out a way of doing that. So I would suggest to caregivers, you should share your feelings with the person you're caring for without being judgmental. That's the kicker. You can't be judgmental, because that just sets up a lot of negative conditions that aren't beneficial to anybody.
You know, I struggled with this too, and I don't think I'm very judgmental, though you can encounter things when you're taking care of another person, living their life for them, where you're not your usual self. But now, in your book, you talk about the issues of being an independent person and becoming more dependent. But I had kind of the opposite with my husband. My husband was a neurosurgeon. He was an in-charge person in his life when I met and married him. And when he was diagnosed with cancer, and it did metastasize to his bones, and he was in pain, he became helpless. And it was really difficult for me, like if I needed to take the dog for a 10-minute walk in the morning, that he would ask me please not to go, or to come back immediately, or to make sure I had my cell phone or something, because I ended up feeling a bit like I was in a prison cell. And we did talk it over, and we tried to work out ways of doing it. Fortunately, we had people that could help us also. But those things can be really hard when you're being a caregiver. They were for me.
Yeah, they are, I think, for everybody. You know, some of the things can be dealt with financially. So, you know, if someone has the means, you can always hire someone to come in and help. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes that's not possible. But there are organizations, volunteer organizations, that can come in and provide that relief that you need. And, you know, I think, you know, that the reduction of stress is very important for caregivers. They're under so much stress, they need to find some way of releasing that.
Yes, I agree with you. And I will say we were very fortunate. Our daughters had talked us into getting long-term care insurance, and we had wonderful caregivers. And we also had a dear friend, Dakey Fox, who lived with us for close to 5 years. And she would stay and look after my husband so that I could get away at times. And that was just an amazing thing for me.
Yeah. Yes. Supportive help is so important.
It was vital for me. I'm a very independent person, and if I had been confined as much as my husband needed me to be confined, I like you said, I would have been resentful.
Mm-hmm.
So gratitude, that's what I want to talk about. You suggest that caretakers graciously accept gratitude, and I hadn't thought of it this way before, but you say as an expression of vulnerability. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think back to one of the first people that I served in hospice, and he, like me, was a retired university professor, very independent, you know, very critical. I mean, all the things you would associate with being in a university position, he had that. And one of the things that really defined him was a need to be independent. And he had congestive heart failure, and he was declining very rapidly. And initially, he would not accept help from anybody. And we've talked about it. And for him, accepting help really meant accepting his condition, which he was not ready for. Even though he was in hospice, he wasn't ready for that.
Yeah.
And I began, you know, to and so there was one time I was with him, and his bottle for urine was filled up, and, you know, I knew it was going to overflow unless I did something. So without saying anything, I just, you know, picked up the bottle, went to the toilet, emptied it, came back, and gave it to him. And he started thanking me profusely for that simple act. And initially I said, well, that's okay. It was not a big deal. And he kept talking about how it was a big deal. And I began to understand that oftentimes when someone who has an acute illness or is dying of an illness is grateful, is offering you gratitude, it is heartfelt. Whether that involves something very huge or something as simple as emptying a urinal. And we need to graciously accept that, because he's not just offering you thanks. What the person is saying is, I am vulnerable. I am dependent upon you. And thank you for caring for me. So
yeah.
to me, that's what's in gratitude, you know, that someone is putting your behavior in perspective in terms of what they need.
Yes. And listening to that story, I also realized, like, that's a man who normally would not have people look after such intimate things as his urine, you know. And
yes.
So it probably meant something even more to him. And there's another really difficult thing that I think is kind of related to it. It's wonderful when you can do it, I think, is to accept the reality of the person who's ill. Many years ago, my first husband's grandmother was in a nursing home. She was 94. And I went in to visit her. And the nursing home was in San Rafael, above San Francisco, in a totally landlocked area. And when I sat down, she immediately started talking to me about how wonderful it was that I had come to the river with her. And something about how I moved my face, she said, oh, don't you see a river? And I said, Grandmother, I actually do not see the river, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. Will you describe it to me? And she described it, and it was very beautiful. And I said, well, I do not see it myself, but it doesn't mean that it's not there. And I want to tell you that I'm glad that I can be here with you. And she just reached her little hand up and patted my face and said, oh, I love you. Because I think because her whatever she was seeing or going through or wherever her energy was, she felt validated and accepted for who she was.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story, and it actually, you know, I've experienced so many things like that. I think
mm-hmm.
what we tend to think about is that the person who is dying, when they're talking about something, is giving you, you know, what's real to them. You know, so, for example, you know, the feeling of the stream. Well, you know, she may not be just thinking about the stream. It may be an allegory to other things in her life. Very good example. I had a patient who would, you know, he was being cared for by his daughter-in-law. And his wife had a stroke, so she wasn't very helpful. He was caring for her. The daughter-in-law would come in every morning to see how they were doing. And one morning she came in, and she didn't find him in his bed. And she, you know, scoured the house, and he was in the garage straightening out shelves, the nuts and bolts on a shelf. And she said, Dad, what are you doing? He said, well, it's too messy here. I need to straighten these shelves out. And so she thought he was being just bizarre, and it was a behavior that she really wasn't going to reinforce. So she forcefully made him go back up the stairs and lay down in bed. She comes the next day, same thing happens. And then she thinks, well, what I did yesterday wasn't that effective. Let me try something different. So she said to her father-in-law, why don't I help you straighten out the shelves? And he said, great. Mm-hmm. So he helped her straighten out the shelves. He became very calm. He went upstairs, and he never came back down again. What happens quite often is that, you know, the person who is getting close to death is not having bizarre behaviors, but rather behaviors that may reflect some of their larger concerns. For this gentleman, what I found out from his daughter is that since his wife had a stroke, you know, everything around the house was unfinished. And of great concern to him was finishing up, you know, was getting things in an orderly manner. Mm-hmm. And so that symbolic act of straightening out nuts and bolts helped him prepare for his own death. And
wow.
there's scores of countless things like that. I had another man who asked me to help search for a manuscript, and I found out there was no manuscript. And this was a gentleman who had always been more interested in goals rather than the journey towards them. So for him, you know, he needed to have some closure on a final goal that he had. And so, yeah, it happens all the time. And I think from those kinds of lessons, at least for me, they provided me with things that should be important to me now before I'm even close to dying. And they've been remarkable.
Mm, yes, and they touch you so much, you know. A lot of people think that working with people who are ill or dying is depressing, and it actually can be incredibly uplifting, as I hear from you also, but I just want to bring that out.
Yeah, when I was doing hospice, every time I would leave the bedside, I would say to the person, thank you for allowing me to be here. I appreciate this opportunity to be with you during this time. And they, you know, often said, you know, why are you thanking me? You know, I need to thank you for being here. And I don't think most people realize that what you can learn from the person who is dying often is so fundamental and so important to your own life that you can't learn that from any other activity.
Yes.
So being in hospice, you know, hospice volunteer for 8 years, that wasn't depressing. That was the period in my life when I learned more about living than I could have learned from any other venue.
Wow. That's a lovely place to end our show here today. I will point out that in loving, supporting, and caring for the cancer patient, you talk about so many other things. You talk about building trust, and you talk about making, you know, accepting where the person who's ill is and not trying to explain decisions they make from your healthy point of view. And I just want to say, Stan, that loving, supporting, and caring for the cancer patient, I have, you know, I've had this show since 2004. I've read a lot of books. This is not the only one on working with cancer that I've read. And your book touched me really deeply. And when I tried to explain to other people during the week that I was reading it why it touched me so much, I said, well, he has the ability to both be inside the mindset of somebody who's ill and outside the mindset. And it's a perspective that I think most writers don't, either they don't have or they don't express quite as much. It's remarkable. It touched me deeply. And I want to thank you for writing all this down for us. It's very, very helpful. So those of you who are listening, if you have anybody in your family or friendship network, even somebody at work, do consider getting Stan's book, Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient by Stan Goldberg, to help you, because it's really wonderful. So, Stan, where can they get it? Where can they get it?
It's available from all online booksellers.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can get it that way. I also might want to mention that I have a website, and on the mm-hmm. website there's over 20 specific articles on different aspects of cancer. They're all free, and you can download it and share it. And the
That's
website
wonderful.
Is Stan Goldberg. writer, WRITER.com.
Yes.
And I also write once a month. I have an article on caregiving on the verywell.com website, VERYWELL.com. And those articles are just on caregiving.
Oh, that's great. Well, we did have a fantastic caregiver through the entire process of my husband's illness, Lynette Rivard, to whom I'm eternally grateful. And she herself was diagnosed with cancer in the middle of caring for my husband. It was lymphoma, and she stopped for a while and healed herself and came back. It was amazing. And she's helped so many people, as I'm sure you did too, Stan. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for being on the show today, Stan. It's been a real gift.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right. So remember that Thursday, December 8th, I'm going to be talking with Lisa Loving Dalton, author of Falling for the Stars, A Stunt Gal's Tattletales. That's at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern Time. And if you can't be with us in person, listen on the archives or subscribe on iTunes. So Full Power Living's producer is Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.